Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Do you feel like you're going through life clouded by doubt? Talk to California Psychics. Our trusted and accurate psychics are available 24/7, and we guarantee if it's not life-changing, it's free. Download the app or connect with us at californiapsychics.com. Right now, new customers get 80% off their first reading. Experience the joy of certainty. California Psychics.
A choice right now, between fear and love. Sister Ron.
Out of the dark night of ignorance and into the shining light of truth.
Expounding reality.
A population of citizens capable of critical thinking.
We don't see things as they are, we see them as we are.
There's a level of reality where everything dissolves into an ocean of energy.
We empower our experience by insisting on our authenticity.
That's very profound.
Very.
Expanding reality.
Welcome to Expanding Reality. I am your host, Brandon Thomas, on this incredibly cool episode. Mark Ollie joins us to talk all things Knights Templar, from the Dome of the Rock and Solomon's Temple to the Bible conspiracies, Gnostic Gospels, Holy Grails, what's going on in this thing. Mark Ollie comes to clear it all up. Absolutely fascinating conversation. And we are accompanied by the always awesome creative expansion artist Polymath Jenny, comes by to pretty this thing up for us, creates an amazing, amazing piece while we are having this conversation. So make sure that you check out the video version below. Now, also check out the link in the show description that will lead you to the Patreon, which is where we are hosting our afterthoughts. Our expansive afterthought for this one goes all into the realm's scale. I am fascinated by this, and I asked Mark all about possibility of dinosaurs not being real, scale being the entire thing with this reality, as well as trees, massive giant trees and giants, and what the hell happened. So support your favorite show in the link below. Support our guest and artist in their respective links. And without any further ado, let's get to this incredibly cool conversation with Mark Ollie. Mark Ollie, welcome back to the show. Holy shit, it's so good to see you, brother. How are you?
Fantastic, and it's great to be back. I've just had a Viking weekend. Doing loads of music and running around in a Viking mead hall out in the fields of Herefordshire. So it's I'm energized. I'm ready for this.
Genitalia exposed to bare ground under kilt?
No, unfortunately not. Far too many sensitive people there for that. But the band on the Saturday night wore kilts, which I thought was quite good. They were a heavy metal ukulele rock band playing pop covers.
What was your favorite pop cover that they did?
Oh, they did so many. I mean, the band was called Frankenstein's Lobster, so that tells you all you need to know. So shout out to Frankenstein's Lobster.
Shout out indeed. I'm going to link them down below. Fuck it.
I don't know if they're out there. They might be there somewhere. You never know. They might be.
Yeah, if I can find them, I will link whatever, maybe a MySpace page or something. Yeah,
there'll be something.
How awesome, dude. Well, it sounds like a blast. I did see a couple of your pictures from this just incredible mead hall, and there's just winches about. You have metalwork going on. Somebody's over there doing blacksmithing. That was really cool, man. It sounds like an amazing time. I'm glad you got to do something like that. That's badass.
Well, I've just posted all the performance pictures. They went up about 2 or 3 minutes ago, so you can see what they actually did musically now, as well as all the rest.
I'll get into it. Well, it's good as fuck to see you, brother. You are, of course, a member of our Frequency Theorists, which I'm going to link down below as well. We've done several of these, and they're a blast every damn time, guys. Also, you have been on this here program episode three different times at least, episode 117, 192, and 238, which also are going to be linked down below. And as you can tell, Mark and I just start talking here. That's just how this goes. So, again, guys, always find him linked down below. His amazing books, which you have been on for in these other episodes that we have, which we are grateful as shit. Good to know you, dude. Also want to make sure to point out to the audio-only audience that we have Polymath Jenny doing some amazing creative expansion work down there for your viewing pleasure. Look at there. Yeah. She is found on Instagram at What Is Jenny Doing, and she's going to be linked down below. Very excited to see what she comes up with. This is just awesome. This is just so cool. Mark, what do you think about all this, dude?
I love creativity. I think it's fantastic. I mean, I went to art college and did that for a couple of years. So the merging, the blending of all the different arts is always a good thing. Always a good thing.
It's incredible. And we love doing this on the show. It's been one of the coolest things ever. Dave Scott from Space Out Radio had me on with Darcy Weir to talk about a documentary I was in, but Darcy made it. And so he was why we were there. And he had an artist there doing this. And I was just like, what is going on? He has the same dude, Filth McNasty, that does this each time. And he was watercoloring something like a spaceship. And it was a doodle. I was blown away. I was just like, hang on. And so we started incorporating it last year on the show. And, dude, I absolutely love it. I mean, it's one of the coolest things. You'll all catch myself talking to you but watching her, which is, again, sort of this is for people whose minds work like ours do, right?
Yeah. Multi-track minds. Yeah.
Multi-track minds. Ooh, I love that. So you have been doing amazing stuff. Where do you want to start with this, man? This is just open form. This is a hang. And I know that we're going to talk Knights Templars, which I'm very excited about. But where would you like to kick this off, dude?
I don't really know where to start. Have we ever done this before? I think we have done one on... Have we never touched the Templars at all?
Not Templars specifically. It's been skulls and crystal heads. It's been Roswell, and it has been King Arthur. But we have not danced in the realm of the Templar. So I'd love to tango with you, dude. Let's do it.
Well, Let's start at the beginning. I mean, most people think the Templars begin with the First Crusade. So some point, you know, they recapture Jerusalem in 1096. The Knights Hospitaller get together and start to form the Hospitallers to treat injured knights. And then at some point, just after that, certainly within 20 years, 25 years of that happening, I'm 100% positive that a bunch of Hospitallers bumped into a bunch of other knights in a bar somewhere on a bit of a drinking spree. And they probably said to these other knights, look, we formed ourselves into an association of monks and what have you under the Catholic Church. And it's working really well for us. We formed this, you know, order of Hospitallers. You guys should do the same. So Hugh de Payens and a few others get together and they form this poor knights of the Temple of Solomon, which become the Knights Templar. We think it happened in around about, I personally think it was about 1114, but the official date for them is 1118. But considering the Hospitallers came in 1113, that's when they were recognised, it makes this whole idea of them bumping into each other in a pub a little bit more plausible, especially when you know that the knights had their own churches, but they also had their own taverns. Every order had its own tavern. So that's really how they get started. The idea is to protect pilgrims on the road from Jaffa to Jerusalem. But there's a bit of a problem there because when the Templars first get together, there's only 9 of them and they only have about 4 or 5 horses. So how they're going to take on the massing hordes of Islamic armies that are surrounding, that run to tens of thousands, is anybody's guess. Clearly, right from day one, they're up to something else. They're up to some kind of mischief. That's, you know, their primary aim is not protecting pilgrims because they could just get wiped out in 2 minutes flat by the enemy. You know, they're clearly up to something else. If you really want me to carry on, I can tell you a little bit more about sort of what they get up to. Okay.
Please, carry on, brother.
Okay, awesome. Here we go. so basically, they end up with this thing called Solomon's Stables. You've got the temple site, which is where the Dome of the Rock sits in Jerusalem. And as you look at it from outside the city, off to the left is this other building, which is a mosque now. But back then, it was known as Solomon's Stables. It's massive. It's absolutely enormous. You could fit about 50 or 60 horses and 100 blokes in there. But they get in there, and as soon as they get in there, it looks like they begin to tunnel. They start digging under the temple platform. So they're going from where they are under the Dome of the Rock, heading for the site of the original temple, Holy of Holies, which is basically next door to the Dome of the Rock. Clearly, at some point, they found something, because by the time you get to 1128, they are recognized by the Catholic Church. They are then, you know, a proper order with a proper set of Cistercian holy orders, which is what they're following. But more to the point, they're filthy, stinking rich. So they've clearly found something. And it's gone back to Rome. Now, some people think it's the temple treasure. Some people just think it's treasure, full stop, loads of gold, loads of silver, etc. Some people think it's scrolls. You know, some people identify this as the start, if you like, of the modern day Vatican Library, which is what we've got now. It's about 3.5 miles of shelving and enough books to keep, you know, 10 scholars going for about 500 years, which is the reason why nothing ever comes out. You know, they don't publish very much out of the Vatican archives because it would just take too long to do. That's the bottom line, you know. Despite what Dan Brown and several other folks might imagine to be down there. But yes, why not? I mean, maybe the Templars did discover scrolls and new knowledge. I'm writing a book which is notionally working title, Keys to the Templars or Keys to the Temple. There's already one out there called Keys to the Temple, so it's a working title. But having started to look at some of the, quote, missing Bible material, especially the stuff that started coming out in recent times, you sort of look at the Knights Templar and you think, okay, on the one hand, they're functioning like the ancient Chaldees, the ancient holy men, the Celtic monks and what have you, because they're carrying swords and they go in threes and, you know, get two blokes riding one horse and all this palaver. It's the kind of thing that the Celtic monks were doing. And they used to worship the head, which the Templars seem to have an obsession with. But then on the other hand, the missing biblical stuff seems to be where their identity is coming from. Which then raises the question, if they're not getting it out of the Bible, then they're getting it from somewhere else. And I think that's where it's coming from. I think it's coming from the extra-biblical material that at that point, remember, at that point, extra-biblical stuff's about 600, 700 years old. So there's plenty of it knocking around in the Middle East. And the Sufis, the holy men, the Islamic holy men, they would have known most of what was in these documents. Some of it actually is probably even more recent, 400, 500 years before the Templars got there. And of course, you know, the Templars might be, you know, French-speaking European nobles, but they still have to be able to speak Latin or they can't, you know, move in holy orders. And these guys are nobles. Well, when you get across to the Middle East and what have you, they're speaking obviously Arabic and things like that, but they can also speak and communicate and understand in Greek and Latin. So Latin is your common language. So, you know, they get a bit of a surprise out there because, you know, the nobles can actually communicate with the holy men out there. So the information exchange, you know, the knowledge that must have been in that melting pot, I would have just loved to have been a fly on the wall. You know, that's a moment in history, transforming moment in history.
Yes, that's fascinating, Mark. It seems you're just so knowledgeable about this stuff. It seems that there's so much in that area, no matter what era it's from. It seems like the people who were there a long time ago that you write about found even older things that were there. So what's the significance of this area, the Dome of the Rock and everything there? Why is it so important?
It goes back, if you really sort of want some kind of tangible origins, then it mentions this thing called Jacob's Ladder, where Jacob in the Old Testament has a dream. Now, clearly, you're not hundreds of years BC at this point, you're thousands of years BC. And he falls asleep and he sees a ladder with angels ascending and descending between God and man. And where he has this dream, it says actually in the Bible that he sets up a standing stone. He erects a stone as a monument to the dream. It's thought that that stone is the first thing to go up on the site at Jerusalem. So that kicks the whole thing rolling. Go forward a little bit, forward, you know, a few hundred years, a few centuries forward. You've then got Abraham. He turns up and he meets the priest king of Salem. Now, the priest king of Salem, it's Jerusalem. So it's the priest king of what is by now a city. So this priest king comes out. Abraham gives him 10% of everything he has. And the priest king then breaks bread and wine with Abraham. And that is thought to be the priest king. And this is going to pop your head. It's thought by some people to be Jesus, but in a pre-incarnation form. Because Jesus says, I will be forever a priest after the order of Melchizedek. And Melchizedek is that priest king. So again, you're still at Jerusalem. And then it just rolls on. You know, from that point on, Solomon and David, they develop the temple on that site, temple number one. And then later on, you get the Romans and Herod and people like that getting involved in the construction of temple number two, which starts in the intertestament period between the Old and New Testament, when they all pile back from the Babylonian captivity and all that. They start building that. So then temple number two is the one that is destroyed in just after Jesus's time in 70 AD. So you've got tons of history. You can imagine Jesus kind of, you know, walking around the streets of Jerusalem, and he's walking around a 2,500-3,000-year-old city already. You know what I mean? And we're looking at it now, and it's like 5,500, you know, 6,000 years. There's been a huge settlement sat on that hill. So it's that continuity. It represents a huge, enormous amount of fairly consistent spiritual continuity. You know, there's not much in the world where you can nail your colours to the mast and say, yes, that's how long it's been there, that's how old it is. But in this particular case, I mean, it was Hebrews in the Old Testament. I mean, Judaism doesn't come in till the end of the first century AD. And of course, there were no Christians at all because it hadn't started yet. You know, Jesus was essentially the last of the Old Testament prophets and the old Hebrews, etc. But it's such a significant site, you know. And again, look at the world religions now. I mean, you've got Christianity, you've got Judaism, and you've got Islam, and they're all sat on exactly the same spot for exactly the same reason. So, you know, it's enormously significant. It really is.
It's fascinating. And again, the knowledge you have about this area and this region and the time periods is incredible. So do you think there will be peace in that area and the third temple built, right?
Well, it's two questions. The second one's easy. Yes, I think at some point the third temple will be constructed. Although if you believe the biblical material, Revelation, it's not constructed by human hands. It descends from heaven onto that location. So that, if you like, it sort of ends the same way it began, with this communication between God and man. It ties that up quite neatly. Will there ever be peace in that area? I don't think there will be until that happens. I don't think we as a human race can really reconcile to a degree where we're happy. It's really annoying, actually, because when you look at those three main religions, they've got so much in common. You'd think they'd find some kind of common ground, you know. Occasionally, if you're lucky, you know, the three major religions do sit down and talk to each other without it ending in a punch-up. You know, occasionally that does happen. But overall, you know, the sort of, you know, believer in the street, you'd have thought they could sort it out by now, you know. I mean, Judaism and Islam, they trace their ancestry back to Abraham. It's the two sons of Abraham that become those two racist, you know, and then Christianity, if you like, is a new build, you know, it's the new kid on the block, although it isn't really, it's got loads of connections. Well, you could argue that Islam is also the new kid on the block. You know, there's a difference of about 500 years, 600 years between the two. And the funny thing is, and this is where it gets a little bit touchy, Muhammad was trained in biblical scholarship by Jesuits who are at this point in the 600s, very much an offshoot of early, very early Catholic Christianity. That's what they are. So there's an interesting book, actually, that was published in America. It's a booklet. It's on Chick Publications. I don't know if anybody remembers Chick Publications. It's a really revolutionary magazine-type book called Arrigo. And if you can find Arrigo, it explains the story in some detail. And it is, in fact, correct. Because the Catholic Church and early Christianity were struggling to find a version of Christianity that was suitable to the Middle East. The way that the Arabs and people in the Middle East functioned was not really suitable to the idea of Western Christianity. So they basically reinvented it. So, the origins, that's a double whammy, you know, biologically and you know, spiritually, theologically, the origins of the two are, well, virtually the same. So, you know, the fact that they're running around now, you know, throwing things at each other and trying to kill each other off is just nonsense, you know, nonsense. I mean, if anybody doubts that, by the way, go and check out the story of Abraham and his handmaiden, Hagar, because Abraham's wife, Sarah, couldn't get pregnant. So she gave Hagar, the handmaiden, to Abraham because they wanted children. And that was perfectly normal back then. So Hagar produces Ishmael. Ishmael's the Ishmaelites, which is the origins of Islam. That's where it comes from Ishmael. So, you know, it's there. It's written there. It's in old Hebrew. It's in the book, you know.
It seems that just really interesting when you boil all this down that they do share common ground physically. But at what point do you think ever there will be an allowance in the religions, or do you think that those belief systems are what is keeping those people from, you know, being able to find their literal common ground?
I'll give you a little bit of irony here, because when it comes to, you know, making war and making peace, Islam was essentially a fairly peaceable, ordinary Middle Eastern, you know, pseudo-Christian branch of the early church, if you like, but it's beginning, if you look at it that way. And they didn't actually have a word for crusade. Now, Western Catholicism and Western Church decide they're going to go over there and, quote, free Jerusalem on the First Crusade, and the Second, and the Third, and the all the way through to number 12. They have all these crusades. The word in Islamic for crusade is jihad. That's the word. It means crusade. So in a really ironic way, we went over there and beat the living daylights out of them, and they've managed to find a way through their belief system now to turn that around and start doing the same thing coming back the other way. You know, so that is a very important lesson, because when the Templars got there, they were shocked at how similar they were and what the overlaps were. The Hospitallers were exactly the same. There's actual illustrations of the Hospitallers doing business between Islamic potentates and kings and rulers, and, you know, and they can clearly speak, you know, through translators, and they're doing business. You know, that's what they're doing. And it's if you look at Kingdom of Heaven, you know, I love that movie, Ridley Scott, at the end, where Balin says to Saladin, you know, why Jerusalem? And, you know, Saladin goes, it is nothing. And then he turns back in a few seconds later and goes, it is everything. And I'm like, yeah, mate, you've hit the nail on the head there. That's what it's all about. We're just fighting over a piece of ground that we should be making peace over, if that makes sense, you know.
The great irony. Yeah. That's what it sounds like. And, I mean, I'm nobody to tell anybody's business, but it is interesting to get a better understanding of it. So thank you. Where do the Templars play into this?
Okay, well, the Templars, like I said, when they first got over there, they were part of this enormous army that was two-thirds made up of Vikings, because you're back in the 1000s, remember, and it was one-third made up of nobles and knights and Europeans and, you know, people of rank. And the Templars basically grew out of that one-third part of rank, because they wanted to basically, you know, rule you know, the Holy Land the same way that they ruled back home. Basically, they wanted, you know, to take over the land. So in that sense, it's, you know, power, money, land, usual kind of politics. You know, that's how it kind of starts. But then as things kind of rumble on, the First Crusade doesn't really cut it. The Second Crusade, yeah, they've kind of, they're in Jerusalem, but the rest of the place is a mess. By the time you get to the Third Crusade, you've got people like Richard the Lionheart going over there. And there is absolutely positive written evidence that Richard the Lionheart is a Templar. He's a member of the Order of Knights Templar. But the way they're behaving at this point, so they've been there a certain amount of time now, so you're into the 1200s, they've been there, you know, maybe as long as 80, 90, 100 years, and they have integrated into the way of doing things out there in the Middle East. So by this point, they are doing business, they are owning property, they are, you know, part of the local economy, they're just another military force, and they start to respect each other on a colossal level. This is what you get with, like you've got, you know, Richard the Lionheart, Saladin, two of the greatest military leaders of the medieval era. And yet Richard the Lionheart won't set foot in Jerusalem. He turns around and he says, no, I am not going in the holy city because I am a warrior and I'm a man of God, a man of blood. So I won't go in. I won't go in because I'm a warrior. So he goes all the way out there, but never actually sets foot inside the walls of Jerusalem. And then you got Saladin, at the other extreme, the Templars at Acre, the last stand of the Templars. There were thousands and thousands and thousands of Islamic warriors against 500 Templars. The 500 Templars basically fought to the death to such an extent that they saved the rest of the inhabitants of Acre, because Saladin just basically said, look, we're going to let you go. You know, you fought so heroically. You've fought to try. I think there was about two or three Templars out of 500 left alive. And Saladin basically said, look, we're going to back off. We're going to retreat. We're taking the forces away and you're free to leave Acre. Just march out in dignity. So there's these little incidents occurring all the time that show that there's a kind of huge, you know, religious and military respect, mutual respect for each other. I'll give you another example. This is a bit long and convoluted, but I really like this one. You'll probably like this. Obviously, Jerusalem is in some trouble because there's a lot of, you know, military stuff going on. So the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which had its own order of knights, decided that it was going to adopt two Rumis. Now, Rumis, that is their word, the Islamic word for Templars. The Templars are referred to as Rumis. Two of these Rumis are entrusted with no less than the Holy Grail. They're given the cup of Christ and the cup of the apostles, those two cups from the Last Supper, and they're taken to a church outside the walls of Jerusalem. Now, this church belongs to the Hospitallers and the Templars, so they go and store these cups there for safekeeping. Eventually, to cut a long story short, it's decided that these cups are going to be sent to Spain in the protection of the Knights Templar. But, and this is where it gets really interesting, Saladin gets wind of the fact that these cups are now outside of Jerusalem and outside the protection of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. So he sends them a letter and he says, my daughter's ill. Can you take a little tiny scraping off the edge of that cup and send it to me in order to heal my daughter? So what do? They scrape a little bit off the edge of the cup, wrap it all up, send it by super fast courier off to Saladin. He gets this little chipping, it heals his daughter, it goes into the royal treasury, Saladin's royal treasury, and sure enough, one of the cups, which now resides in Spain, has a tiny little cut taken out of the lip. Now, all of that came from, believe it or not, Islamic shipping receipts. That knowledge came from, if you like, the opposition. But it's true. It's absolutely true. So there's all these things going on. You know, it's not just thuggery. And I mean, yes, there was, you know, all kinds of massacres and things that happened out there. And very much like in the Kingdom of Heaven, the Templars were warriors and that's what they were all about, you know. But I don't think they were quite as nasty. They weren't the bad guys that they painted to be in Kingdom of Heaven. But and also a lot of cooperation and respect between the two. There you go.
That's amazing. That's it. But this source was found because of Islamic shipping receipts. They basically could track the back and forth of this tiny little piece of metal, and that they could track it to this cup, and then therefore it reflects physical object.
A couple of scholars from Spain went over there, I think it was in 2012, and they were, although they're Spanish, they could speak and read the Islamic texts, and they started going through just from a historical point of view. And they found a shipping receipt. They found a shipping receipt for the Holy Grail. In fact, they ended up finding three or four, and this letter from Saladin, and they strung them all together. I think the book came out in 2016 that has the information in for that. I managed to get most of the details into my book on King Arthur, the Polychronicon of Merlin, Joseph and Arthur. I managed to get that story in there. But from a Templar perspective, it kind of changes the way we look at things. You know, it kind of mixes it up a bit.
What do you think about the Holy Grail? Do you think that the powers it claims to possess are real?
Okay, that depends which grail. I mean, the overriding statement, you know, the Templars protected the grail, right, that comes from Parsifal, which is von Eschenbach's romance, which clearly states that it's Welsh Templars, because Parsifal is a Welsh person, and, you know, it's kept in a castle in Wales. Now, that particular grail is probably the two cruets that were buried with Joseph of Arimathea. But I've got 27 other variations of grails. So it's inevitable that one of those will have been, or many of them will have been, in the possession of Templars somewhere. And then you've got the question, well, what is a grail? Well, a grail actually is a functioning communion vessel. That's what it is. A graal is the container that contains life, either physically, because it's got wine in it or porridge or bread or, you know, grain-based material, or spiritually, because it's that cup that follows on from the Last Supper. Now, you've got to remember, in medieval times, what we're talking about now was completely unknown to the general population. There was no easy read version of the Bible. That only comes in 1611 with the King James. So it really was a mystery. The whole communion thing and everything, it happened behind a screen, the rude screen in the church, so only those most holy, monks, knights, etc., could participate. The public had no idea what it was. So it was everything it says it is. It was an invisible divine mystery. But to the Templars, it was one of their number one, if not the number one, most sacred ritual. I think it's even part of their initiation, I think, would involve some form of communion. So, yeah.
Wow.
Does that answer the question?
No, it absolutely does. And I didn't know that there were so many damn grails. I mean, this is how you do. You come on and totally tell us that the stone in the sword that King Arthur was messing about with was actually more of a mold in it. So you like blow our minds with new things when you come on. And it's never let down, by the way. I feel very enlightened by you with this. And so to discover now that there are more than one grails, do you think they'll give you different superpowers? Like one will give you laser vision, one will give you psychometry. Or do you think that it's more of just a mental thing? Like this guy getting his daughter healed, it seems like in my mind, it would have been a way to sort of locate and verify that the cup was where it was and then go attack the guy and get it. That's where I thought you were going with that story, by the
way. No.
Because I thought he'd be like, haha, because he sent me a piece of it, I know where he's at, and therefore the cup is real, and so we'll go get it. But it is interesting to then have it twist into that it was actually, he really did genuinely want to heal his daughter with it and then just let the guy have it outside of the walls of Jerusalem. So yeah, it's just fascinating, this folkloric element to all of this.
Well, the cup with the bit missing, that's thought to be the cup of Christ. That is thought to be, you know, capital T, capital G, the Grail. That's thought to be the one. And the other one, the other cup that was with it, is thought to be the cup of the apostles, which is the one that gets passed round at the Last Supper or whatever, cup of the disciples. So that's two Grails already, right off the get-go. And it would appear that anything that was associated with the Last Supper and anything that was associated with the crucifixion, both of those things qualify as grails. So technically speaking, you've got the Veil of Veronica, the Turin Shroud, all the fragments of the cross, the nails, the crown of thorns, the titulus, which is the signboard that went over him with the inscriptions on, anything at all whatsoever, his robe, anything that's associated with the crucifixion could be protected as a grail. And then you've got the same situation occurring with the Last Supper. So you've got a dinner service capable of keeping the Passover. So that's, you know, there's 13 of them. Then you've got 13 cups, 13 plates, 13 bowls, etc. So, and it's thought, incidentally, I mean, this is extra to any factual information. In legend, it's thought that the upper room was in the house of Joseph of Arimathea. Now, Joseph is quite significant because he takes away the blood and the sweat of Christ in containers from the crucifixion. So it also appears that anything that's associated, so like the lance that of Longinus, spear of Longinus, that's a grail in itself. So again, it's all these things that are associated with those two occurrences. Yeah, they all qualify.
Any of the props, yeah, on the set.
Yeah, literally.
Even the Spear of Destiny.
Yeah, yeah, if you can find the right one, because the one we know about was made in the 7th century. It's a fake. You want a first century Roman one if you want to find the real one, which might be buried, but it might be buried with Emperor Constantine, actually. It might be in his burial mound.
And what's interesting, the movie's Constantine has the Spear of Destiny in it, and that's what gives the dude, you've got this. It's all connected. Yeah. How interesting. Yeah. You know, because I wasn't sure, because I did, of course, hear that you could, that something was gathered, the blood of God, Jesus was gathered with a cup and then taken away from the crucifixion, right? But was that cup the same one he drank out of? That's what I thought. I thought it was just a cup that was being passed about.
That's the confusion.
There it is.
Because all the objects, all the objects are separate. They all have separate functions, but they're only connected by where they start life. So that particular one is thought to have been a bowl. So very often you get a wooden bowl or you get a glass bowl that is used to collect the blood at the crucifixion. You see it depicted in a medieval manuscript. Well, there's a couple of glass bowls over the years that have popped up and been claimed to be the grail. Hence this idea that the sangreal is green, or it's green stone, or it's green glass, or it's green crystal. So that takes you down that avenue. And then, you've got all these wooden bowls. Well, you wouldn't use wood for the Last Supper because it holds impurities. So they wouldn't have used that. They'd have used glass or stone. But there are some grails that are made of wood. So clearly they're from elsewhere in the story.
Those are the salad bowls. You know,
yeah, they're the, yeah,
at the grand, what they rocked
around
finger
bowls, yeah, for washing your fingers in, but
right. It is just so interesting that everything associated with it's sort of like, you get a grill and you get a grill and you're a grill and you're a grill. That's just fascinating. So, is the Shroud of Turin a grail then? Would that be considered a grail?
It's super, super grail. I mean, Geoffrey de Charnay was the preceptor for France at the end of the Templars, when they were all arrested in 1307, and he was executed in 1314. At the same time, the de Charnay family bring the Turin Shroud to the church, and the church then takes over care of it. So it's thought the Templars actually got it from one of the raids on one of the cities. I'm trying to remember where it is. I used to know where that was. Oh, never mind. Anyway, they brought it back. So as a thing, it was in the possession of the Templars. When they were on trial, they were accused of worshipping a head. And it's interesting that when you fold the Turin Shroud up, what you get is just the head. That's all you see when it's folded up properly. So maybe it was displayed just as a face in a frame, which would explain where that head thing comes from. But, I mean, the latest opinion is the Turin Shroud is certainly certainly looks like it's genuine. It's anatomically correct. It's on a piece of Roman material. The tests that have been done on the chemicals and the substances on there, they're all coming back as human. You know, there's blood, sweat, various body fluids on there, etc. So the evidence is really racking up. I mean, they started looking at it in detail in the 1970s, and it's, you know, is it or isn't it? But I think we're at the point now where it is, you know, it certainly looks like it's the real thing. And like I say, the Templars and the Hospitallers certainly believed it was real.
That's so interesting. And it's fascinating too. So what's the tie-in with, is there any tie-in with the Caduceus and the symbol of the Caduceus and the Knights Templars? Because if they were founded as Hospitallers at first, I mean, they would have had that Caduceus logo as their going. Is that what would have happened? They would have had like that as their forefront. Is
wow.
there any tie in there?
There is. It's a very, very deep rabbit hole to go down, but I'll try and keep it as punchy as I can. Go all the way back to Moses. Go back to the Old Testament, okay? The Moses and the Israelites, they're going across the desert. They hit a particular bad patch in the desert and people are dying from snake bites. So Moses basically says to God, what do I do? How can I get round this? And God says, look, you fashion a snake out of brass and you stick it on a pole and stick it up in the air. And when anybody sees it hanging there on this pole, they'll get healed. As soon as they approach this serpent pole, it'll heal them. And that's the Caduceus. That's why it becomes a representation of healing. But the way that links in is that is exactly the same as Jesus nailed to the cross. He is the thing that removes the sickness, the illnesses, the sin, etc. When you gaze to him hanging on that piece of wood, he becomes the serpent of Moses. He becomes God's healing being, if you like. And that's the tie-in. That's how they tied the imagery together. So, yes, the Caduceus is a Christian symbol. In terms of what we have now, where it's used, you know, outside its context in the medical profession, that's slightly later. The Asclepius, which is the double twisted serpent, is Greek. So Asclepius, the idea of a healing serpents on a pole with two of them, with a little set of wings, that's coming from Greek rather than Hebrew mythology, if you like. But in Hebrew mythology, that's what it is. It's the serpent twisted around the pole of Moses that brings healing to the nations.
I'm so glad I asked. Damn, that is fascinating. So, and then Moses is tying, of course, with the staff and the snake. You know, I mean, there's just a lot of symbolism wrapped up in there. So why do you think that they use the animal that was able to apprehend man into the fall as the thing that would then heal? And because it was then represented as Jesus. So they were then equivalent and the same. Do you think that that was a little nail on the head as far as, hey, as above, so below, it's all found here. God and Jesus are the same thing. Or Do you think that it was some sort of apprehension to make it a little bit more of their own and less glorified? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it kind of depends on which path you've chosen. I mean, people would say, you know, if you're bitten by a snake and you look at a magical snake, it's sympathetic magic. You know, it's a healing snake that's undoing something that a real snake has done. So it's cancellation. But then you can apply that in a really big universal spiritual sense. And you could say, okay, it was a serpent. Actually, it was a lizard because it had legs, but it was a creature that cocked it up in the Garden of Eden. And at the end of the day, it's, you know, another creature that undoes it on a bigger scale. It's, you know, it's a human this time.
Like
it's,
the Jerusalem and the Third Temple thing. It's what'll end it.
It's one of those amazing tie-ins. You know, I always say that the Bible's the greatest book of shadows ever written because it's, you know, human experience over thousands of years, you know, par excellence. You know, it's incredible. And the tie-ins, you know, between books that are written thousands of years apart, the way it all ties up is spectacular, you know, and that's one of them. That's one of those tie-ins. So very often in medieval iconography, when you see Jesus hanging on the cross, you'll find a snake in there somewhere. There's a snake in the picture somewhere.
I have seen this. I have noticed this. Yes, there are a couple little tidbits that hang around with Jesus, and the snake is there. Well, also the story of him and Satan bartering for Job, right? Isn't it Job that he throws all the plagues and shit on? Satan's like, hey, this guy will turn on you. And Jesus takes him up on it. Come on, man. It's just interesting when you see the correlation here and how they're sort of a dual set.
If you look at Jesus as being God, I mean, you know, the physical form of God, he's the angelic form of God, he is God, you know, etc. That's a perfect example because, you know, Lucifer turns up in heaven and goes, hey, have you seen this guy Job? Yeah, if I have a go at him, he's going to curse you. And Jesus or God or whatever you want to accept goes, right, knock yourself out, mate, go and see what you can do. And the best part of that story is by the time you get to the very end of it, you've got a human being, Job, who defeats Satan. So actually it's like, yes, what a happy ending, you know. But it's the same story. It is the same idea, you know, that even human beings, you know, I mean, we're given as being higher than angels, better than angels, you know. Angels desire to know what we know, you know, they envy us for that. And that just plays out exactly like that in Job. You know, it really does. But the interesting thing with Job is, though, it's before the flood. It's a pre-flood story.
Okay. So, I bet the angels are just jealous because we only have two eyes. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and we've got genitals and they haven't. So,
the genitals as well. Yes, I forgot all about that. Oh, yeah. That's amazing. Okay, well, what do you think about the Gnostic Gospels, the things that are pulled out of the book? You say the Bible is one of the best books ever written. Do you think that it can be added to or taken away? Is there anything that you'd pull out that you think is a little unnecessary and redundant? Or is any of the Gnostic stuff, Gospel of Thomas, any of that, would you, Enoch even, would you toss that in the mix and read and make it a collection?
It kind of flips the other way. Yet again, I'm going to go over left field and then I'll you know, bring the ball back into the court.
We are here for it, Mark.
If you were to study the real Bible code, so forget Michael Drosnin's nonsense, throw that in the bin, load of rubbish, that's Sudoku, so don't bother with that. If you actually speak to somebody that knows about proper Hebrew Bible code and knows how it functions, they will tell you that the 66 books that make up the Bible, the Old Testament in Hebrew and the New Testament in Greek and Aramaic, when it's converted into numbers, it demonstrates an incredibly complex code. The code is running right through all of those books on so many levels, to the point where we can't actually reproduce it. We can't cheat and do our own code. It's far too complex. There's only a computer that can really decode it. Bearing that in mind, the next question then is, well, what about all the other books? That's the question. What's hanging around in all these other books? Somebody somewhere, when they put those 66 books in the Bible, knew exactly what they were doing, because the code only exists in certain bits of the other books. So by applying the code, you can prove mathematically that those other books, the ones that are left out, have got bits that have been tampered with. So the two answers basically are, would I throw anything out of those 66 books? No, I'd pretty much leave them as they are, which is what's happened in the last 1500 years. I'd just park them, go, okay, there, that's it. That's it. However, and this is where it gets interesting, when the translations were done, we didn't have the Dead Sea Scrolls. We didn't have the Nag Hammadi Library. We didn't have all the extra Gospels that we've discovered since. And it turns out that some of those have got some really interesting material. I'm not saying that they are divine in themselves. What I'm saying is there is some divinely inspired material in there. There are bits of that. So is it a worthwhile exercise going through them and trying to fish the bits out? Well, the answer is yes, of course it is. I think there is extra material that's worth studying that will give you an insight, if you like, into the more human side of the other 66 books. You know, I'll give you a great example. There's one book I've run across fairly recently called The Gospel of Pilate. Now, what's interesting about The Gospel of Pilate, Pilate's the one at the crucifixion that washes his hands at the trial of Jesus and says, I really don't want anything to do with this. This is not my bat, not my ball, not my game. I'm having nothing to do with this. And he washes his hands. When you get to The Gospel of Pilate, you find out why. Because that is a legal statement. It's a Roman legal statement, and it absolves him of responsibility before the emperor of Rome. Okay. Now, in the Gospel of Pilate, the emperor sends for Pilate and says, Oi, what do you think you're doing? There is no way you should have crucified this guy. No way. And the only reason Pilate gets away with his life is because he washed his hands. He went absolutely meticulously through the legal process, the Roman legal process, and it goes out, the responsibility goes elsewhere. But looking at it in the Gospel of Pilate from a Roman point of view, where you've got a totally different account written in Latin, you know, in Italy, as part of the Roman prosecution records, which have then been converted into this gospel, it's fascinating. You know, Pilate's wife became a Christian because she had a dream that Pilate should not execute this prophet. So that's another reason why he washes his hands and doesn't want anything to do with it. And then when he gets back from Rome, because he's now alive, you know, I mean, he got absolutely rollicked by the emperor for what he'd done, but he got away with his life. When he gets back, he converts. So if that, you know, extra gospel material is correct, you're going to find Pilate in heaven because he's innocent. You know, the story it tells from a different perspective really does cast extra information. And the same thing happens when you read things like the infancy gospels, Gospel of Judas, completely different. So now we're drifting into Gnostic material. The Gnostics had a different view of what was going on. Now, I'm not saying they're right, because it's not divinely inspired material, but it's interesting because even at the time, people had a different opinion. Now, we tend to think that those 66 books, that's it. You know, that is just it. That isn't correct. People were wrestling with it as an issue and trying to work out exactly what had happened and why and how. You know, they were looking at it from different points of view. Excuse me. So they're really useful for changing your perspective. But you can't go around, you know, quoting them verse and line like you can the scriptures themselves. You've got to take them with a pinch of salt. But, you know, they do certain bits marry up. Gospel of Thomas is a great one. There's a shed load of material in that you don't find in the four gospels, because chances are it was written down as a set of notes. There's some bloke, you know, following Jesus around like a news reporter, and he's writing stuff down, but he doesn't always get it the same as the other four guys. But it's interesting, you know, it's interesting extra material.
It is. And this makes, I think, more of a complete story. And so do you think that religions are really just sort of a stair step, or do you think that they contain the end all be all of all information? I mean, clearly there's more context to be gleaned out of things that are found beyond just that one book of the Bible. Plus, that's one book of one religion. And we have a bunch. Plus, Christianity alone has how many thousand different varieties and flavors that you could pick between that all sort of disagree slightly with one another in some interesting way. But I just find it all fascinating, man.
Well, it goes in two directions. I mean, the first thing I'd say is if every single human being that had ever lived and will ever live and is alive today was all pushed together into one being, you'd be getting somewhere close to God. You know, you get close to the divine, because we're all little chips off the old block. You know what I mean? We're all individual divine. We're all little gods, you know, with a small g, which is biblical. It says so in there. So I think, no, you can't throw out the baby with the bathwater. I think there's a huge amount of stuff that you can learn. And then the second thing that annoys me is people go, well, you know, you can only read the Bible. It doesn't go any further than the Bible. So you read the Bible and the Bible says, hang on a minute, you need to look elsewhere. So the actual book itself is telling you, don't just stop at the Bible.
It references Enoch. Yeah.
Well, there's all these other books that are referenced, but sure. More than that, it's saying, well, you know, God is imminent in everything. It is there in everything, you know, male, female, neutral, whatever. It's in everything. So if you're, you know, a little pygmy sat in the middle of the Amazon rainforest somewhere and you haven't got the foggiest idea what's going on in the rest of the world, there's nothing to stop God speaking to you from the environment that you live in. You know,
why do you think God tells people to rape and murder so much and do wars and stuff like that? Why do you think God's so into that generation after generation?
Well, the Bible tells you not to do that. So what happens
is, if we're all divine and we're all pieces of God, then it seems that the God's gaslighting us by saying that, right?
Well, it's the devil story, isn't it? It's the Satan story. It's the somewhere right at the beginning, the whole point of the whole Garden of Eden story is the beginning of our time and our race, because you know, there were more genetic races in the past. Goodness only knows what they were like. But in our particular instance, we blew it. You know, we started down a road that we should never have gone down. It's used in the symbolism of trees. You know, you've got the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and you've got the tree of eternal life. Well, the reason we don't get near the tree of eternal life is because we'd live forever with the knowledge of good and evil. So we'd stay as we are permanently. So that tree of eternal life is taken away. It's removed. It doesn't come back till, you know, the New Jerusalem and all the rest of it in Revelation. But anyway, I'm getting off the point a bit here. Human beings are a dab hand at passing the book. You know, we just pass the book. Oh, it's, you know, it's God's fault. It's this, that, and the other, you know. No, I mean, anybody now, this is where the kind of the proof of the pudding is in the eating. Anybody now that has access to the internet has no excuse for blaming God, because the amount of human information, the amount of knowledge, the amount of data, you know, the amount of news, you know, and current affairs and what's going on is vast. It truly is vast. So that's what we can do. You know, we make that. We create the internet. We put all the stuff on there. We see what is out in the world through this tiny little window. But you can't blame God for all that. You know, it's impossible. When you start to pick it apart, you can see what humanity is doing. You know, we err towards the demonic and the devil and the, you know, the whatever, the physical, the non-spiritual, you know, we just that's the way we are. We go that way. But that doesn't rule out the fact that the rest of it, the divine and all that, that exists. And we have divinity, but then it's still our choice what we do with it. That and if you want to see choice operating in a really bad way, just go and surf the web.
Dude. Because like you said, as we created that, other people are exploiting and creating platforms to sell people on it, like sell human, you know, so it's just really interesting, man, when we think about this place and we start talking about divine inspiration, because if it's all divinely inspired, then all of it is inspired by God. Then that means everything here is something God wants. And, you know, God chose to express here in some degree. It's just interesting when we start to look at it from the occupant's perspective, that we start to see that we'd rather maybe quite a sweeping amount of things be completely different. But as we look back in history, and you've seen, it's just slaughter after slaughter after slaughter. It's just it's just interesting that it just seems to be a loop of sorts. I wasn't offered the chance of the apple in the Eden, you know what I mean? We just sort of got saddled up with this shit. So what do you think about that? Do you think that like personal choice, singularity, or do you think this guilty by association with humanity sort of a thing is, let's say, godly or fair?
Well, we're definitely going down the Gnostic rabbit hole with this one. No doubt whatsoever. Basically, we've got two viewpoints wrong. There are two things that we as human beings really don't deal with very well. The first thing we've got wrong is the idea of death. Because let's face it, anybody, anywhere that dies for any reason is a bad thing. You know, it's bad. That's just how we view that as human beings. Yes, I get the idea that, you know, once upon a time there wasn't death because it came about as a result of what happened in Eden. But by the same token, maybe it's just not the bitter pill we think it is. Maybe it's not as bad as it seems to be. I'm not belittling anything, but nobody gets out of here alive. So you can moan and complain about, you know, babies dying and people starving and wars and famines and et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, if we looked at bailing out of this place as being a good thing, that would cease to be a problem. You know, just disappear overnight. So that's one thing that you know, we need to home in on. The whole Gnostic thing, that's the sort of second part, if you like, is the idea that if God has created everything, vis-a-vis he must have created, or it must have created the devil, must have created evil, etc., etc. Well, that quite firmly rests on whether or not you believe that there's an overall plan. You know, it's like, does God know what it's doing or doesn't it? That's the bottom line. Now, the Gnostics, I mean, they just cut right through everything and they just went, yep, knows exactly what it's doing. There's a start, there's a middle, there's an end. That's what it's all about. Yes, of course, you know, Satan, Lucifer, all the angels, etc. Of course, it's made by God and it's for a purpose. You know, there's a purpose behind all of this. There's a kind of a nifty little get out clause that says, you know, if we could fully understand it and know exactly what the purpose was, we'd be God. You know, that's
well,
the problem.
This as well, in reference to when you figure out the game, the simulation would just stop or reset itself or something like that, right?
Yeah, I mean, going down that route as well, you know, somebody has to run the Matrix, you know. The Matrix is at its barest root is pure mathematics, you know, but mathematics of a colossal, vast, you know, amount. The more we've looked in things, you know, going smaller into fractals and bigger into the universe, and it's way beyond us, exactly like the Bible code, you know. It's clear, you know, whatever path you follow, be it spiritual, magical, whatever, it's very clear that that structure, that mathematics exists in absolutely everything without fail. So if you go down that route, you know, the as above, so below, we have a lifespan. Everything has a lifespan, even the planet, you know, the galaxies, everything has a lifespan. Outside that, that's where you need to start looking for the thing that started it all and created it all and put it all in place. Anybody that knows chaos formula and things like that, chaos theory, knows that none of this has happened by accident. It's impossible. It can't. You can't get this uniformity on such a vast scale out of nothing. It's impossible. It's anathema. So mathematically, there clearly has to be an initiator of some kind. Now, talking science, talking matrix, talking whatever, it's the programmer. You know, it's the thing that makes the matrix. That's what it is. You know, call it God, call it Allah, call it whatever the hell you want to call it Mother Nature, call it whatever. There is definitely something, and it's bigger than us, and it's invisible, and we're a part of it by default, you know, whether we like it or not, for better or for worse. You know, as you rightly say, we get clobbered for whatever's happened in the past, and the poor old sods that are coming after us are going to get clobbered for whatever we leave behind, you know. But you can only hope that there's a plan. But don't forget the first point I made, and that is that there is a get-out clause. You know, sooner or later, our time runs out. And that's that. That's just how it is. So we're not stuck here forever. We just have to make the best of it while we're here.
I just love talking to you this. We're going to go down a deep philosophical rabbit hole in the afterthought here. So you guys definitely check the link down there to support your favorite show. And we'll have Jenny join us for that as well. And she is doing an amazing job, by the way, down there. I just want to remind everybody to check the video version of this, because that is just so cool. As you start, you see it working and you're just like, what is it going to be? And then it keeps getting more amazing. So thank you, Jenny, for doing that. That's incredible.
I mean, just bringing it back home and bringing the illustration in. I mean, if you have a look at the Templar cross, the idea of this flared equal arm symbol in a circle, that actually encompasses, it encapsulates pretty much all the basic principles of mathematics. It's all in that symbol. And it is in itself a mathematical symbol. So what I'm speaking to you now, the information I'm passing on here, I would say if you went back 1,000 years and you went and sat down and had a chat with a Templar, you'd get the same information. They would tell you the same things. It does appear that we haven't actually gone off topic. That's basically what I'm saying. You know, we're still talking Templars.
Oh, yeah, no, because I want to know what happened to the Templars after the Crusades. Like, where are they now? Is there an infiltrated sly group of Templars just out there doing quiet handshakes, you know?
Well, it's you know, you've got all these nice kind of, you know, convenient history books that just go, ba-boom, that was the end of the Templars. Rubbish. Absolute nonsense. I mean, we can pin down the end of the order in France because the French king ended it and managed to persuade the Pope at the time to end it. But by the time you get past 1314, you get down the line to 1380, you've got the same Catholic Church absolving the Templars of all wrongdoing. It's in writing. That's something that has come out of the Vatican archive. So, yeah, the Catholic Church are basically saying, yeah, they were innocent. We shouldn't have got involved in this. You know, they were fine. But even in France, they didn't go around killing the female Templars. And in southern France, 2/3 of the order were made up of lady knights. Then you got all the ancillary people and all the prospects and all the other knights that managed to get away. So you've got huge thousands and thousands of people that didn't just end up getting burnt at the stake. They reckon it was about maybe 600, 700 people that got burnt at the stake in France. Everybody else got away. In this country, it's in the UK, it's interesting. We had three kings on the bounce, all called Edward. So, you know, Edward I, Edward II, Edward III. They weren't very original in thinking back then. But the Edwards really liked the Templars. They're like, yay, fantastic. So it got to the third Edward. So you're now talking 1334. And he's kind of, he said to the temples, don't you think you'd better like get off the Pope's land, you know? So they did. They just walked out of England into Wales, Ireland and Scotland, none of which were within the Pope's reach. But they'd had all that time to move all their stuff. And all over the Templar world, what the Templars did, as soon as they knew the days were numbered, they gave everything to the Hospitallers. They gave it all away. So 80 years later, the French crown was still trying to get the money because they'd just given it all away. And then, of course, the Templar Navy sailed out. You know, they all got arrested on Friday the 13th of October, 1307. But on Thursday the 12th of October, 1307, the Templar Navy sailed away with all the treasure on it. So they clearly got tipped off beforehand, you know. So, no, it didn't just die out. I, you know, people go, oh, where did all the money go? You know, maybe it went to Scotland, maybe it went to America. Who knows where they went? And, you know, there's a big clue staring you right in the face on the Swiss flag. Think Swiss banking. It's a white flag with a red cross in the middle. You know, what is that telling you? Basically, the Order of Knights were all over. Everywhere they were in, you know, Switzerland, you know, Yugoslavia, Italy, Greece, you know, anywhere, pick any country you like. And certainly the European Templars, all they did was rebrand. They just changed the name. You know, they became Knights of the Cross and Knights of Christ and Knights of this, Knights of that, Knights of the other, and turned into mercenaries. So basically they just sat where they were, pulled the Red Cross off and stuck something else on. So, you know, I mean, you've got things like the Order of the Fleur-de-Lis. They trace their origins all the way back to 1486. They still exist. But they were made up of a contingent of Templars who combined with European knights for a specific battle, you know, back at that particular point in time. But the point is, the knights were still there. You know, they were there to be called up. So by the time you look at the scattering of knights and, you know, there's even a possibility, for example, that Catholic Templars, as Templars, might have hung on and continued, you know, to form things like the Knights of Malta, Knights of Malta and Rhodes, Knights of Cyprus, you know, people like that. Again, they've just changed the wording, but they didn't even bother to change the colour. There's still a red cross on a white background. And they float off and become black and white as well. In France, they change the colours and things like that. So it's just a universal rebranding, you know. They had a limitless resources, you know, at their disposal. So they could do it. They could just change, you know, stuff this guy in France, this king, you know, that owes us, you know, 2/3 of his kingdom, stuff him. We'll just, you know, rebrand. We'll do it a different way. So I don't think they ever disappeared, because at the moment you've got them in the temples are in Catholics. They exist in the Catholics. I think it's the Order of Cross of Constantine possibly is a Catholic order, but certainly there are offshoots of Templars in Catholicism. They exist independently, so you will find, if you Google search, there are a lot of independent orders of Knights Templar, most of which are probably resurrectionist orders. I mean, there was the Order of Good Templars back in the 1800s that were a temperance movement. You weren't allowed to drink. It was just the temperance movement. But they issued certificates all over the world, you know, for conclaves to form up. And then, of course, you've got the Knights Templar who are still in the Freemasons. You know, you've got Hospitallers and Templars. They're side by side in the English Rite Freemasonry. So clearly a lot of it survived, is basically what I'm saying. And that's just a random selection of examples.
Oh, it's absolutely brilliant, and it leads us into our afterthought. But also, it sounds like something. Didn't the Nazis do that? Didn't they just, like, because they didn't end in Germany, right? They just sort of Project Paperclip their way of
their interest.
Paperclip their way over here and just did something else. They rebranded, right? They just took those stickers off and was like, oh.
Yeah, they did the same thing. But they also have their own order of Templars known as the Teutonic Knights, and it's a really nice story, the Teutonic Knights, because the order was one of the most powerful. And it's German, so it's, you know, and it was there in the Crusades. It's, what, 800, 900 years old, and it's a black, like an iron cross on a white background, you know, and they survived. They survived so long that the last knights were dying out in the 1950s and the 1960s. By the 1990s, the last knight died, and it went back to the order, went back to the Catholic Church. But at that point, the ruling monarch of Germany said, I'll tell you what, I'll have it and I'll resurrect it for the new millennium. So they came back. And I'm like, yes, that's incredible for a medieval order to just vanish and then come back again. And they started again on midnight on the year 2000. It's like, fantastic. So these orders, sometimes they disappear, but you can, you know, apparently if you're a monarch, you can bring them back.
Interesting. And why Y2K, you know? I mean, that's interesting. Okay.
I think he just did it for his New Year's Eve party.
Just round it off.
Bring back the Teutonic Knights. They're a charitable order now.
Wow. It's just always so fascinating talking to you, dude. So we have more to talk about. So let's kick this off and sign off here, but we will go into this afterthought because we have a lot to talk about in here. I'm going to talk to you about aliens and scale, too, and see if scale is the whole damn thing to this, okay? Deoculation and scale. I think you're going to like it. Okay, so sign up for your favorite, to support your favorite show down in the link down there so you guys can check that as well as all the other bonus content that we have. We replay the Hangouts there, all kinds of stuff. Want to remind everybody as well to check out the link in the show description for not only Mark and all of the ways that he is found as well as been on the show, but also for the journal. We have new videos that I've put up for the Mindful Expansion Journal that will walk you through that thing. You can learn it in 30 minutes and it's all there. So check the link down there and thank you guys again for your support on that. Mark, before we let you go, dude, what gets you out of bed every single morning and keeps you moving forward to come on shows like this and tell us dope shit, dude?
Wow, what an amazing question. I want to try to remain relevant and make a difference to people who are out there with the knowledge and the information I've got. I am a Gnostic. I always try and tell the truth. So that's what I want to get out there. Let's get the truth out there. That gets me out of bed in the morning.
Just want to take a moment here and thank Mark Ollie for dropping by and dropping the hammer of the gods on this Knights Templar conversation through your host's brain fog here. So thank you so much, Mark, for making something out of that episode for us, buddy. I also want to thank our creative expansion artist, Polymath Jenny, who created this amazing piece. If you're an audio-only listener, check out the video version of these type episodes so that you can enjoy the artists that we present. All the ways to find both of these amazing folks will be located down below. Now, also, there's more to this conversation. Mark Ollie and Polymath Jenny and I continue this thing with scale, realms scale, possibly size of things, mantis beings maybe just really tiny and then grow real big to present themselves in front of you as if they are large. I'm fascinated with scale, so we talk about it. Dinosaurs possibly not being real, trees, all the things, guys. Check that out. It's a wonderful way to support your favorite show. Also want to mention here our new journal that we have released. This is the first time I'm mentioning it, so check the link down in the show description as well. Redigional Publishing has published its 8th journal, guys. Go check that thing out. We have a video series located on damn near every platform, so y'all can check out how to absolutely navigate the Mindful Expansion Volume 1 journal with beautiful cover art by Janine Burgess. But also, we have a Mindful Expansion Volume 2 that just released, video series coming very soon, guys. But check that out, available on Barnes & Noble Press and Amazon. Very, very grateful for this thing. Thank you guys so much for your support. To go out into this wild-ass realm, whatever the hell this thing is, it continues to present itself in interesting ways, and you continue to navigate them flawlessly. So congratulations, keep going. Keep moving forward while you're out there crushing it at life in general. You may as well go ahead and pick up a piece of litter. You see it blown around there. Be nice to everyone that you come across. You don't know what their story or their day is like. As well, get the fuck out of the left-hand lane if you've got somebody behind you who would like to pass automotively there. But above all and anything else, guys, go out into this incredibly mysterious realm that continues to elate, excite, and exuberant all the senses here at infinitum. And y'all just be good to one another. That's what it boils down to, guys. Just be good to one another. Thank you so much for watching, listening, subscribing. And y'all just thank you so much. We'll see you next time.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
If you want jazz music, go to New Orleans. Bagels, New York. And for psychics, think California Psychics. You want the best, you go to the best. At California Psychics, home of free spirits and open minds, we know better than anyone what makes a good psychic. That's why we guarantee, if your reading isn't life-changing, it's free. Visit californiapsychics.com and experience the joy of certainty. California Psychics.